Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about a patchwork of amazing things that I've learned in the last couple of days. They're things like how mosquitoes actually do work, and an error I've had in my understanding there, through to different forms of art experiences. They're things I've learnt, experiences which have surprised me in a sort of patchwork. And if you're in a regime of trying to learn things and explore things and go up, you do have these periods of times where just information comes in higgledy-piggledy. Now, I'm often yet another cardiac walk. People in podcast land have been listening for a little while may listen into this type of stuff. And look, although I might be improving in, say, the 1 out of 1 to 10 objectives, I might be improving 2 of them. Majority of them, of the remaining 8, I'm either going backwards or just treading water, weight gain and, I suppose, peak exertion, endurance, I think since I'm sort of going backwards. And cognitively, I don't know exactly how it's going. But on this sort of thing, if you're curious, you have these open accounts, so to speak, in which you have decided, oh, I will study this a little bit more. And the first one I want to talk about is mosquitoes. Partly because I saw, I think, a New Scientist diagram a message that I worked out from New Scientist. I suppose it's a misreading. I had little jaw teeth at the end of mosquitoes. So female mosquitoes have to take in blood. And one of the things, as I read a description, at the end of their proboscis, or little thing which spikes, they have teeth, a sucker, and a remover. And the way that I read that is that the mosquito just sits on top, and these little teeth operate like a tiny mouth at the end of a long straw. And I suppose it's the way that I imagined it. I think I sort of imagined actually a diagram of it. I don't know whether I actually saw the diagram of it, just reading the text. And then I think I watched a advertisement of a mosquito. No, it was a TV news article about a mosquito eating. It was very obvious that the mosquito wasn't just sitting on the top, gnawing away the first couple of cells and having a blood. It was actually going in. And then I had a deeper look at it. And what happened is that there seems to be a needle which goes in, and the sort of housing of the needle goes off to the side in a bend. And this got me really stunned and confused that, you know, it does bend forward, but the part of the needle doesn't go into the flesh, but it bends, buckles up, and another part goes in. This is sort of ultra confusing. And I asked an expert a little bit about it. He wasn't into the actual studying of the mosquito bites. And so I thought I'd do a little bit of internet research. And it took a fair while. It took about 2 pages of YouTube videos to go down for an exact description until I actually hit gold. And it explained the mechanism. Now, I suppose I'll at the end I'll explain that mechanism for you. But there's sort of another rejoiner for it. It's sort of the realization, as I discover this information, and the fact that no one else knows it, or no one else in my area knows it, and no one cares to know it. There's sort of this sobering thing that no one seems to know. Okay, so you've got a mosquito, and it's got this biter, which people think is initially a strong hypoderm. Now, in fact, what the there is a sort of fairly large sheath with a slit in it and a ring. So the large sheath and that sheath can roller up the needle. So it's got there's a protective sheath on its needle. And so as it goes in and bites, this sheath gets pushed up, much like a jumper being pushed up your arm, but it's relatively solid and it flicks out, exposing. So if you imagine you've got a tube over your needle, the tube's full at the extremity, the tube's fully around, and that acts as a bearing which can go up, and then the protective sheathing can fold up outwards as you go along. And indeed, that's one of the very first things when I looked at detailed photographs, microscope photographs of mosquito eating. You've got to look from the side. So the way it's often pictured, it's very hard to see. It's sometimes the actual biting process is covered by the body, or sometimes it's front on and you don't see it, it's bent forward. But from the side, you'll see this sheath bends forward, and that exposes the needle. We know the following things is that needle has certain tools. It's got mouth part tools, sawing tools, it's got a saliva tool, anticoagulant tool, and a sucker tool. But to my surprise, the actual needle contains 6 independent needles. That's correct. So this sheath goes up and basically exposes a Swiss Army array of 6 simultaneously independent needles. And what happens is that 2 of the needles, so we'll go number them, 1 and 2 are identical, but they have at the end of it so these are incredibly fine. That's 6. So if you imagine the stinger or the needle that's going in that you can see, well, most of that is housing, pretty of housing. Underneath that is some fine, 6 fine needles. 1 and 2 have on the very last 5% very sharp braids. So this is within cell sides and it actually cuts the cell. So it goes around and cuts ligaments between the cells. So your cells, each one of your cells, if you squish your fingers together, you can feel that they're soft and liquid filled. Like if you press your finger feels as though it's full of liquid, and that scales right down. Now, if you imagine your index finger and longest finger together, and imagine it's stuck, a bit like by some sort of soft type of glue. I'm just having a good look at this. There she is. Casing out the place for night recording. I'll just go back on that, and then I can't ask you to remind me to get you back onto this point of night recording. Imagine your fingers, the end of your fingers are good examples of what a cell actually looks like and feels like, magnified incredibly large 5,000 times. And your fingers will be stuck together by little ligaments between your cells. So your cells stick together, are bound together by tiny little fibers, interconnecting fibers, which connect them together. Otherwise, you'd be able to just wash them away. So a cell in your body has to be stuck to your body. That's one of the things. This is not always the place, sort of. The stick has got gaps between it, and if necessary, a white blood cell can squeeze out between cells, can just work its way around the body But the mosquito hasn't got that luxury. It uses needles one and two to cut the cell open, and then it uses two and four, sort of with muscles on it, to pull it aside to, so it drills and cuts it and opens up the hole. So there's actually no pressure for needles five and six to go in. Now, five and six, I don't know whether they actually separate or how they separate, but they go in and they move around and probe, and they have a chemosensor on it to sense blood capillaries. So it opens up the cells and hunts around for a capillary. This is a very fine, I suppose, vein artery. It's not actually, it's the crossover. Capillary is the crossover between a vein and an artery. So this is filling with blood cells. So this will move around and poke around there. And there's a gradient of chemicals. Now, I find this part of the description a bit hard to believe that there is the cell has a gradient of particularly complex chemicals. There is obviously a salt or an iron gradient between the capillary and the rest of the cells, and this iron gradient winds up in forming a osmotic pressure. So if you get a slight additional osmotic pressure as your bulk blood is slightly more salty than the remaining tissue around the outside, and your blood has got sort of like 30% or 40% albumin, which is this nutritious protein, but it has the job of transporting micronutrients and pulling out sodium from your body. So your body is made relatively less salty by this albumin. It creates a salt gradient inside you, between the kidneys and that type of stuff. That's molecular physics. The molecular physics is rock solid. How the body actually organizes it is a little bit more questioning. Molecular physics is the actual basis of a lot of this. We should be saying we're at 5 and 6, which is the feeder tube and also saliva tube. So once it actually cuts open the capillary, so it's going to get into the capillary to suck it out. So this is really small. A red blood cell is very small. You'll get platelets forming. This disruption will form a clotting, so you need a certain amount of saliva. And this goes up into your mosquito. So your mosquito going in, it's the sheath goes across. I don't know quite how you could describe it. It's like a sock with a hot a hold in it. It's sort of like these... you see some women's dresses that way with a cut in the side of their sleeve. Obviously, their elbow doesn't go out of it, but it's sort of covering a knot. And then you got these six needles, one and two, cut, three and four, separate, and five and six, five eat, six lubricate. And this draws up the blood, and a thing that is shown by the is shown in the videos. So this is all confirmed by videos, and it sort of starts to explain a whole heap of things. Basically, an error that I had. I didn't realize that these six separate needles, and they all separated out. I thought they were all six separate functions in a single needle, sort of as you could imagine. But this is sort of pretty amazing stuff. So the final needle, which goes in and probes your jewelry, is just doing exactly like that, because it's open. It's sort of like surgery. So in surgery, you have your scalpel, then you have these grappling hooks which lift open the wound, and then you can get in there and do surgery. So it's actually doing basically, Masseter is doing surgery on you to find it, and it's actually with a surgeon's precision going into you and actually harvesting the blood. And that was a bit of a revelation for me. It sort of did I feel bad that I didn't quite understand first time around? Yes, I did. I feel sort of secure that I didn't actually, at a dinner party, if there were, is ever such, click the glasses or make up diagrams. But I think that's fairly safe, because I'm a long way from teaching it. But this is sort of a, I don't know. Oh yes, sorry, there's another feature that the mosquito does, is as it's drinking the blood, it has a membrane which the blood is put in pressure, and the water escapes through the membrane. So it secretes tiny little droplets of water at the back, pure water, with the blood product on the inside. So it's a sort of a very, I suppose, interesting thing to do. It sort of makes, now, of course, harvesting blood is, typically, you're pretty safe, because blood is pretty, in terms of viruses, sterile, because there's no DNA in it. But the parasites have heaps and heaps of DNA in it. So, so a blood cell, red blood cell, is sort of like a filled-in donut. The donut hole is where the nucleus should be. The nucleus has been extracted simply because it blocks the blood cell moving it, doing its job. So with a nucleus, it can't do any repairs, fill itself, can't do very much with the inside of the cell. It's sort of just got, I suppose, the red blood cell has mitochondria in it, I would expect. And basically, it's basically a dead zombie cell. So your blood cell, blood cell can't reproduce on those lines. But if it's infected, or if there's any parasite in there, that parasite needs to convey its information, so it's got DNA. So that's one interesting aspect of it, and that was a bit of a wake-up story for me. The next sort of thing is sort of taking a relative around to, I'm just going to mention this in slight in passing, because I began to see the differences in it. We walked over a new $56 million footbridge, sort of an artsy styled, wooden, very aesthetically pleasing bridge, which spans the Nepean River, which is at the foot of the mountains up near Glenbrook. And when I looked at it, I could see through into the river. So the first 50 centimetres of water was clear. Then after that, it was progressively dark, and you could see the plants, and you could see, if you watch hard enough, you could see fish jump out, if you're lucky. But normally you would just see the ripples of them entering, and you'd be able to work back when they were jumping and stuff like that. So I saw this extremely beautiful, but my relative, who's got a different view, says, look, the water's incredibly dirty, and there's rubbish in it. And the rubbish, obviously, was just only natural plants growing in there. And, you know, and I suppose you would say, you know, normal, you have to quite understand that this is a pretty wide river, but it's got a weir at the end, so it's not really flowing all that much. So it really is this extended, really a long lake with it, that you look at it for basically a recreational, long, sort of small, 5 kilometre long river, I suppose, if you're lucky. Navigable is probably 3-4 kilometers is navigable before it gets really rocky. Now, if you go up to the mountain streams feeding it, they're all clear. But it was just a experience for me in that we had my view of it was one, and my view got swept aside because it's very, like, if you're intellectual looking at these funny things, it's easy to just shut the door on everything. And so if you've got a view, they can have, people around you can have a polarized view, and it's sort of like a democracy. And so it's gone. It's sort of, you're left to appreciate it yourself. And this goes on to, after this we went along the river. Along the river is a, called the Lewis Regional Gallery. So there's a Margie Lewis, who's an artist who bequeathed her house and property to the people of Penrith to house a gallery. And this has been sort of the hub for community participative galleries. So there's an education centre there, and they had a exhibit pretty much on loan from the Powerhouse Museum. It's called the MAAS, I don't know, Museum of Applied Sciences or something like that. And essentially started off with a few items. I'm going to sort of mention this because it'll sort of put you to sleep a little bit. So they had a basically Great Depression furniture. This is where people had converted a 44-gallon oil drum into a set of drawers. So each rung four levels of drawers all coming out. All the drawers were sort of like a little cheesecake coming out. I don't know how artistic or how authentic it is. But then there was furniture made out of the old wooden sewing machine bobbins and wood structured. And so that was nice. And then it went out to various 1960s design, curved furniture, stuff that I grew up with, sort of aspirational stuff. And it went to some almost hoax, over the top, top designs. So there's a very famous spacecraft, Buck Rogers spacecraft lemon juicer, designed by a French person, put out in 1990. Of course, this is, would be a reconstruction. Like, it's old enough, but it's really post-authentic. So authentic is something which is made in the 1960s, sort of a 1960s homage. So it had the elements of 1960s things, but executed so exquisitely well that it's turned into a piece of artwork. Beautiful lemon juice. And I suppose what was just interesting is that for all these sorts of things, I can appreciate it, but I don't have to have it. Whereas the people saying it with me, saying, "Oh, you really appreciate that," I wonder if you can ever one day buy it. And of course, for me, it's observing it. Like, I wouldn't have any friends around to squeeze the lemon juice. You know, I wouldn't be the sort of person who would have a party and, oh, 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 clink, 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 what I'm doing. I wouldn't take the art and actually build it into my existence, because you'd have to have all this phony friends, people who cared, you know, you want to, I don't know. Then we went to the Arch Gallery, which is this sort of cafe across from this, and this is sort of a fairly flat futurist, modernist, new modernist home, going inside, and on the wall they had pictures of modern home design of this artist who actually took the actual segments, the colouring, the mustard colouring, and actually simplified it a little bit. So in the furniture, when you looked inside this big picture of a house, you'd see the furniture, but it would be a silhouette of the furniture. So it's sort of like simplified in certain ways to actually pick up the modernistic lines across. And suddenly struck me that this large picture was the very... This was a painting of the actual house we're in. And it took me a little while to pick it up in terms of that the very modernistic 1960s modern set of shelves had obviously, it's not a museum fixture, it was actually part of a museum. There's pictures like that. And I said to the people there, various people who saw the river as dirty, who saw the squeezer as only in the lens of can you have one, then insisted that the particular house they were looking at in the pictures had been demolished, and they were sure they had read it in the literature there. And the literature on the side, the blurb on the side, didn't say this was, they said it was of Archer House, and we're in the Archer House Museum. But it didn't say that you are standing in the museum of the art that you're looking at. And they had insisted for a long while that, in a sort of very, I don't know, putting down way, sort of a bittling way, that no, I was mistaken. It was, it had been demolished. So, but clearly we were standing in the house, and I was able to say, we see this feature there, that corresponds to that feature you can see over there, that feature there corresponds to, and eventually, after a bit of a battle, I was able to, so I was actually, artistically immersed in this artist idea of actually doing a representation of the space that the observer was in and accentuating it, and simplifying it and drawing it in such a way. It was like this cosmic experience, yet the certain people who, when they see that, are just not tuned into it at all and insist that it's dumb. And then when you can finally push them, I wasn't necessarily pushing them, but they were sort of at me, saying how stupid I was. And then, so I pushed this on. And the instant that they realized that this was there, they moved on instantly. Okay. And I think that really touched me, because I was actually in an artistic exhibit. I was actually part of the artistic exhibit. And, normally it's when you see art, it's an internal, sort of private internal process, because the people that you're speaking with want to move on, or if you speak with another person who's similar, you're embarrassing and all this type of stuff. But here was an intense experience, because when you were had it, this experience, you got the next solution for free. So what was it? What happens in this situation? Well, this light gets wiped, and so they're back to the same point of denial. And then a little bit afterwards, if you've got to say there's an art building, a shop, there's a little complex there. So toilets, an education centre, Archer House, which is a modern, and then the Old Homestead House, which is sort of classic classic house. I can't quite describe it. It's got the corridor in the centre, and the rooms going off to the side, and an outhouse on the outer, and sort of slate roof, rising roof, where the everything's corrugated iron, or it's sort of hard to sort of the pitch roof is sort of like a European picture, but with the veranda around the outside to get some sort of cool in the heat. So this is one of the things we're struggling with at the moment. The days up here are 42. Quite frankly, it must be 40, getting up to a bit. I think, yeah, there's parts in Australia where it's hitting 50. These famously hot places are hitting 50 at the moment, so it's quite hot. We go in here, and to my to the first sort of exhibit that I see is it's got police tape down, and there's a couch, sort of a sofa, which is down, sort of which is sort of a domestic sofa, and there's cartridges, sort of shotgun cartridges all over, and then you look at the sofa, and the sofa is split in two, a sort of a light floor on one side, then on the other side is a set of twin shotguns, sort of pistols, sort of combination between the old stylized pistol with that sort of bulbish pistol grip, a trigger, and then obviously shotguns going in, and it transforms with bows, and eventually becomes more feminine into white, and there's flowers, this is sort of suddenly very intense, like the actual, and then you look up and you can see some of the paintings that are of this motif, and it was only afterwards, after I studied this artist a little bit, that I began to unplug what's going on, sort of how powerful this is. And of course, if you don't know about this artist ahead, and you, and I think this is what really ruins it for a lot of these art installations, is that for me, it's greatest when you've got no idea, you're just walking along, and you're totally unbriefed, and you have this instantaneous response to it. So I have a look about this, and I said, oh, look, hey, this is about domestic violence and all this type of stuff, and the people with this, I say, think we have to move out of here because it's to do with violence. This is a bad exhibit, and which sort of gives you an idea to where things may be good or bad. The your looking of it is not your moral. You're not looking at it and investigating it. It's not a moral judgment of it. But again, that was again an intense thing, that I was provided two levels of experience. One is the level of interaction with the art, and then interaction with peers. There's me interacting with other people who were not like him. And then I went next door. So there's six rooms in this place, and it was this by group of Aboriginals performance artists, and they were having, I just saw a short session of it, and I just absolutely fell in love with it, and they were organising a dinner party for, I think, 8 guests, and on the nameplates they had the Aboriginal names and the Aussie names, like this, and they were setting up the dinner party, and then they were going around flipping, should it be the Aboriginal or the Aussie names of Wayne or what you, you know, I can't even pronounce them, but fantastic. And they were sort of having a bit of a spoof about it, and they just, it's like a laser shot through. And it's, if you can imagine, stand-up comedians can have a certain sort of time zone where they build up, and it's they have a certain audience, but this is a different medium for the same sort of concept to go across. Then the other rooms were these sort of convict clothes for women, six convicts' clothes for women, and how they were really bound up, you know, money, comparative beauty. And look, there's just who's around here. It's getting around. You got a few nutcases around here. Oh, bloody hell. Sorry, this is a sad. There's people camping here. And this is, oh, they're in a car at night, which is okay. They're shining their light at me, checking that I'm okay. I suppose it's all okay being here at night. Yep, okay, so, g'day. There's a, okay, so the... No, I'm not, I'm just a random.
Sorry, my friend's freaking me out, I don't know where he is.
Oh, have you lost him? Fair dinkum.
Yeah, and he's freaking out too.
What, have you got phone contact with him?
Yeah, but he doesn't
know
where
he is.
He's freaking out.
So, she whiz. Stop this. I'm doing it. Okay, just starting up again. There's someone who's just a little bit drunk up on the bush path. So I kept to the road and... there's just a bit of scare about that because it is a canyon, and I just spoke to the friend, calmed her down. But if sort of if I come back and that he still isn't in, we'll just get the cops in. Talk at they just love this. They spend all their time. Well, it's hard to say. Just it's insane. Like if the cops can't find them, they're calling the choppers. It's pretty sad. So it's been a pretty busy time out in the Blue Mountains with the choppers, at least going around this time of year. There's a whole lot of inexperienced people just wandering off the tracks. And now, of course, the problem with the tracks here is that. Firstly, it's easy to get disoriented, particularly in the dark, especially if you're not used to walking in the dark. That is, you're lost. If you use a torch, you're lost because you don't get your night vision up. And there's these holes, not on this side, but on the opposite side, up there. These are holes in the ground, which go through a chute and shoot you out of a cliff. There's about three or four holes up on the other side. Like, there's no way I'd be up there at night. Just having a look. It's insane. Just absolutely insane. I hope that person's okay. Okay, getting back to this. Just have a look. This artist... Oh, yeah, the final rooms was tapestries built out of waste material. And essentially, these people just, whatever they ate or whatever they, and if they even can, they'd strip the can down to the strips and weave it into the tapestry. And so you'd have this rug tapestry up here. And then it would say, a tapestry of, consisting of, and there'd be just a list half a page long, or whatever, a chocolate wrapper, a cough lolly wrapper, a old condom wrapper, whatever it is, they'd just strip it down and weave it in. It was just such a beautiful exhibit. But getting back to this particular first exhibit, this was very, very... confronting and very real because I was in there and the people these were females, but they were saying, well, don't even touch it. You know, they're repulsed by even talking about it. And then I sort of read the story of it, and the artist was, there was a collection of artists doing this art installation. So the person who did the beautiful graphics was someone called small e, capital X, de Medici. Now, what was that? How old was this person? And stuff like that. And I, after looking at this a second time, went to a room and, because these exhibits are just so touchable, they have a volunteer there taking stuff out, and she was trying to get a survey. You know, you had to write, fill in a survey of your reaction to it. Of course, the people I was with is, you don't give away any of your own information, your own views or anything, so don't fill in the survey. But we talked about it, and I was able to talk about, find out from this person that they'd just finished school, they're volunteering, and, what did they hope to do, and a bit like that, and did they enjoy this particular artist, and was it very powerful stuff, and indeed. But then they gave me a sheet, which they're able to look after. And so I'll give you some of the detail afterwards. Then afterwards, we left there, and the outhouse was done again with the shower curtain in the same motif. So it was really interesting that the actual motif was then put into a computer generation, and so it was printed on various forms in different ways, and then the floor was made out of shell casings, neatly put together, and the actual shell casing was this spade. Now, I actually don't know what the symbol of the spade means or what it was trying to pervade, but it was this feeling of this tension. So, fortunately, when I got back, I was able, and so this, again, I've got a little video of this intense in outhouse. So, if you're in an outhouse, you don't expect it to be an art exhibit, and so it's extreme. And so, this combination of, there were flowers and self-such flowers and things like that, and I am concerned. I'll tell you what, it is so quiet if you go into the bush and you know what you're doing. In general, this is about this time of year, you get yobs, and the place, this area was yobs, was crawling with the people in around 2000, but after that it's been really, really quiet. So this, if you imagine true wilderness with no one around the place. Okay, that being said, we've got, I feel really concerned about this particular person, because there is strict protocol that if you're lost in the bush and you're a bit unstable, you have to sit there and let experienced people find you, because I was just walking past this cliffs on the left of me, and this person, if they, they did the wrong thing, they'd be, I can't describe. Okay, so I looked after this ex de Medici, and now what's really interesting is that as I've looked at it, every time I've spoken, I said, look, I'm interested in this artist, this general hostility. So it was sort of like a mutual coordinate system where these people are, and information out to me, which sort of reflected, and it's sort of like a searchlight which shone around me, and sort of showed my the hostile world in which I live. But this is a Medici person, was born in 59, I was born in 63, so she's 59 years old, or something on that ilk, around that era. And her medium is 2 artistry. And immediately the clarity of Tutu is this thing, you can't have sort of shades and stuff like that. So she used watercolour and tattoos, and tattoos is this great mixture of guns and daggers and roses. This tattoo medium is this fantastic medium with which to move. So she's a tattoo artist, and she works with scientists, and she documents the tension, the commercial tension between mining these virgin areas of Australia, and we lose these species. You know, a species may be in a small area. You know, it's all these random species here. Some of the species are widespread, some species have got small areas, and often by the time the mining council, mines, people have found the minerals there, that they set up a timetable and set up that it makes it very hard for the scientists to go in. And so, that being said, that's her job. And so, in certain things, she looks at butterflies and moths, and looks at the tension of drawing insects, entomology insects, to 2 artists. And what she likes drawing is the gun, because the gun is the final solution. The thing is, I trigger it's a symbol of power. So, for me, I'm very much aware of bullying, yeah, but also bullying means nothing unless it's in the context of an imbalance of power. So, it's from the individual looking out, it's a, they experience bullying, but from the outside, it's an imbalance of power. But for the imbalance of power to operate, you need these steps, these sequences from which you cannot argue. And that's what she said, that she likes the rifle, the exposed rifle, that and the expense cases, the shot has already been fired, the situation has already been precipitated, and so that's just so powerful. And then she does other things of skulls, like the shot is a skull, and the skull is the final statement. And it's and what's so powerful about this is the tension in her art. It's just fantastic. The execution of the art is fantastic. It's got a currency because it's tattoo art, but it's got this medium, as in paintings and stuff like that. Then it's actually transformed into scenes, like in a bathroom scene, a shower curtain, or it's like this is, it's very, very graphic, but then is it art? Because it's repeated as in a fabric, and, it's just an incredibly powerful statement. And, the thing is, unfortunately, reading some of the stuff is quite powerful, or is quite intense, and you want to go out there, but unfortunately, it's unfortunately for a dim like me, it's in code, so I don't know what the symbol of the spade means, and whether it would be interesting if this person had any whether this person in her personality had shades or nuances which aren't into art. And reading about it, you sort of, oh, I don't know, it's sort of a fascinating thing, that where the art is the artist is part of it all. So it's that was an incredible experience for me. And again, I think all these things are when you've got your analytical antenna up, and they're unscripted. So seeing you're in a bridge and you want to enjoy the bridge in a particular way. So this is for me an intense feeling, the bridge, but you have this experience and you have the intrusion of someone interpreting differently and leveraging their interpretation over the top of you. You sort of feel, sort of intensifies that. Then that leveraging the interpretation on top of you when you go into an artistic home. How artistic is that? You're seeing a painting and the penny drops that's a painting of the room and the house that you're actually in. and it's then communicating the language of saying it's like this communicates across, but then the people fighting at the moment, and then withdrawal. It's sort of like the people aren't there to be with you. They're there to contain you, and when they can't contain you, they're gone. And that's the entire case with it. And the many, many differences. So I'm looking up at these pretty big cliffs and think of this person up there, but she was, you see these shadows out here, and you hope it's not a bloody body dropped down. If he's not in, I'll call in the cops. So this is almost towards the end of this exploitation, the sort of the awareness of it here. And of course, what's happened is my cognitive abilities going up all the time. So I'm perhaps being able to see a painting and redraw it, or I've visited this cultural centre in Katoomba. So 40 kilometres up from Emu Plains is Katoomba, up to the top of the mountains, more than 40 kilometres. 50, it's roughly 100 kilometres wide, Blue Mountains. Doesn't seem much, does it? So the middle is Katoomba up the top, 900 metres. Emu Plains is 30 metres, so it gives you a sense. It's slow, you really wouldn't notice your car's going up. Sometimes there's one or two places where it goes into drops a gear, but the rest of the time it's pretty norm. And for me, that was that intense feeling where people were open to the experience, but there was a negligence here. I'm at this weir, and basically I'm on deck, so that means I've got to do these family duties and look after kids and take people around the place. For all this idea that the people view you as something contained, and then when you get to equality, they've gone, because they're really off. They're really not interested in you at the fundamental aspects of it. That's really reflected, I felt, in the tourists that were up at Katoomba. There was Australia there, but there was no Australianness to interact with people. The Australianness was in cafes where the Australians were, and they sort of kept away from the tourists. Now, one of the things that got me was having read more about the Aboriginal stories, was one story of, or two stories. One is as the whites occupied certain flat lands, there was whole of other river lands in which the Aboriginal communities lived. And there's one story of a Catholic mission coming up, providing education and food and work and gardening. Now, one of the things that people, I suppose, didn't know, that the Aboriginals were already cultivating yams. This is one of the confusion. So yams, some sort of fruit. And just reading along there, at a certain point, there was a Catholic mission up the Warragamba. So this is a dam. You're reading this civilization story, and you know that come 20 or 30 years after the action that you're reading, the whole place is going to be flooded. So it's this very intense feeling of these people interacting, and essentially there was some trust broken between the Catholic mission and the local Aboriginal community, and they parted ways. And of course the Aboriginals came off second best. So that was an interesting thing to read. Then there was just a small segment. There's also segments that, the more you know about it, sort of deconstruct the myth, the macho, mighty masculine myth of the Blue Mountains with a more nuanced myth, or nuance, I suppose everything's a bit of a myth. But there's this small section up in Katoomba called the Gully. This is a backland, and essentially Katoomba, there's these little hanging swamps. Yeah, what happens is that before the waterfall, some sort of debris builds up, and before the waterfalls, it builds up. The hydrography is really fascinating. So, at the top, rather than being deserts, these areas are actually full of water. It's actually swamping. They're called hanging swamps. And so most of them, you follow this creek, and then just follow the creek, and then suddenly it's this huge cliff, 100 meter drop beneath you, these spectacular cliffs. So it's dense land. But this gully, this something called the gully, is something which is going at 90 degrees to these gullies. So it's a flat area. And this is where the Aboriginals and white people just met and co-mingled, and that's all it really said about it. And you sort of say, oh, I wonder where the gully is. And then it said, I think a committee of 53 businessmen formed a committee and evicted everyone from the gully to form a race course. And you went, what the heck? And we know that further up behind Katoomba is an old airfield and an old racetrack. And I don't know what they're like, but they're sort of pretty spooky places. They're abandoned things. When you know, you say, well, I know that country is a pretty dry country. I can't imagine people cohabiting there. And, you know, that's a bit of a way out. So that's about 3 kilometres north of Katoomba. This is pretty amazing stuff. There's an airfield up the top there. And I don't know where any planes can land there, or, you know, be struggling to land a light plane up there, and an old racetrack. There's racetracks everywhere in Australia, but what are they? There's the economic powerhouse behind them has long gone. It's much cheaper to have pokies, and people are less mobile with the time. They're sitting in front of TVs. It's, you know, that culture's long since dead. So these 53 businessmen, I don't know what the timing of this is, but it's around the turn of the century, 1900s, pretty awful type of stuff. And we then went on to the lookouts, and there's a classic tourist souls lookout, and then there's a very spiritual lookout that I went to. And going around from that lookout, you go along and there's some sort of unusual houses, some rich people's houses, some alternative houses. Sort of, they can really make you think, some of this house. And then a little sign pointing back towards the Katoomba. So this is now 4 kilometres further along the cliffs. go back, saying the gully. Now, normally, it would be, I don't know, you'd have to know the significance of these things, like up around Springwood, I think it's Birdwood Gully. It's actually quite a steep area. It's not really a gully at all. And that's where all the glowworms are. So you go for a night, and it's quite a cosmic experience. You're walking along, and underneath this cliff, there's this eerie green glow. And here, for me, for all this artistic and unexperienced thing, to know the actual significance of this tiny sign pointed to this people. And I sort of have a strong feeling that these people as well have these things that they want to say, the way they want to act. And what happens is that they're held in abeyance, and the moment that it's convenient for people to take them to the slaughterhouse, it's all bets are off, you have to go. I don't know, I've experienced that one sort of 3 or 4 times, just in very gentle ways, where you believe or feel things which are transcend your local environment, and you sort of is kicked back. And when you realize that, yeah, I'm beyond help, I'm going to think differently, moving back. And sort of all came together as an experience. Okay, well, you can hear me panting more as I'm going up the steep grade, and that's what I have to keep on doing to build up my endurance. Do various other exercises like boxing and balancing and stuff like that. And I'll go up and just check in on these young people. I think I've done the right thing. Like, even down here, this is, it's like, it's really, sorry, I'm just looking off the side of the road here. Not a particularly big cliff, but you wouldn't see anyone again. And this person's, fortunately, well, the cliffs, the mini cliffs here are only about 1 or 2 metres, but you'd break something. And he's got his mobile phone. So I think that people know where he is. So it's there. Like, I definitely would not leave the road at night, unless, I don't know. Okay, thanks a lot for listening, and from mosquitoes to tattoo artists to XA de Medici to dispossessed Aboriginals with a story which is lost between the pages of something or other at Katoomba Cultural Centre. Thanks a lot for listening. Okay, just a conclusion for the missing person up. So the cops have finally arrived, and they're pretty good. In terms of you can see them travelling at fair speed here. And I was keeping company of the girl who's looking after the person. And yeah, this is a serious situation, because someone a bit drunk and a bit depressed in this dangerous area. So I'm walking away. So I sort of walked down and up the gorge. And I think I did the right thing. Just saying, if it didn't resolve, phone the police. Just phone the police. The police are here. And I just stayed with her until the cops arrived. And so they're on to it. And it's pretty amazing that they have two sorts of modes. One's when they've been, there's a power play type of stuff, where there's someone's trying to challenge them, and they have to exert authority, but when they're in their rescue mode, they're totally different, and sort of when they're out and about helping. And so, oh, I can't describe the, I don't know, it's been in a number of situations where people, there's been chemical accidents, road accidents, industrial accidents. I just tend to know, I was actually driving past, pulling out from a fence place, looked across and I saw this person standing on the road, side of the road, work gear, hand on his hand, and he'd given himself a serious cut. And he was unsupervised, apprentice unsupervised in a site, and we got the people in there. So it's really interesting in terms of they say, like with that particular girl there, they said, or she said, "Who are you?" "I'm just some random." And that's how I'll be recorded in the police reports. Some random. And when she phoned up her person. Now the, it's really interesting that there's also a subplot that these people who take these risks and go out these things really require, the system requires that they're looked after. So that's the second end to this podcast, where you've heard it happen. But for me, it's this poetic story of people interested in interacting with you till they can contain you, not being interested and then moving away. I've seen that sort of like that theme repeated four times in a short time. And then what I discussed was having a chat with this girl about, she was very depressed, he was very depressed, all the story, but it's exactly the same thing. People were interested in interacting, managing the effect of the depression on other people, and the moment it was resolved, they'd move away. And it's, so it's one of these beautiful little things where there seems to be a common theme throughout it all. No, that doesn't make very much sense, but thanks a lot for listening. Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.